You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of IAS 2007, the fourth International AIDS Society conference on HIV pathogenesis, treatment, and prevention. Sydney, Australia, July 22nd through July 25th, 2007.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the Body's coverage of IAS 2007. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of The Body, and I'm here in beautiful and cold Sydney, Australia with Dr. Daniel Berger, Medical Director of North Star Healthcare in Chicago and a Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I should note that Dr. Berger is one of the authors on the Titan study and has been an investigator on some of the studies he is about to discuss, including the DUET and SHAPE studies. Welcome, Dr. Berger.
Hi, Bonnie.
Dr. Berger is going to provide an analysis of a few important studies that were presented at IAS. Dr. Berger, let's start with what I think is the biggest news for people living with HIV, and that was the hepatitis C study. Can you talk a little bit about this study?
Bonnie, this study is probably one of the most important things coming out of the meeting, because as a doctor, and probably most doctors in most big cities around the United States, and now we know especially Europe as well, we've been noticing that more and more of our HIV-positive patients have become co-infected with hepatitis C, and this has become a problem because we don't really always know how the best way to manage those patients. It's so difficult when we have to attack one virus, but now we've got two of them, and it's not like you can just take pills like you do for an HIV cocktail and just suppress HIV. You can't do that with hepatitis C. We don't have a cocktail per se. We only have two antiviral drugs that we use, and one of them is interferon, which means that individuals have to self-inject themselves once a week, and the medications themselves are very immunosuppressive. They have lots of side effects, and it's not at all a walk in the park. In fact, people that are on hepatitis C treatment often feel like they've aged about 50 years. So the study that is being presented here at Sydney, in such a beautiful city, is a study showing that hepatitis C is a dynamic that continues to change. We started seeing hepatitis C increasing a few years ago. Previous to that, we thought that hepatitis C could only be transmitted through intravenous drug use or through blood transfusion. But over the last few years, we started noticing in the clinic that more and more of our patients are becoming hepatitis C infected. And we know from the patients that we see that most of those individuals are not intravenous drug users historically and have not received any blood transfusions. So various studies that have done previously showed, actually, that because of changes in behavior among the HIV-positive population or among men having sex with men or gay men, that there's something changing in terms of the increase in hepatitis C. So this study actually looked at over 170 patients who recently became hepatitis C positive. All of the patients in the study were HIV positive to begin with and are gay men. So they took the blood of these from these men and did a lot of different genotypic testing. In other words, they mapped out the genes of the hep C virus itself and try to figure out where those hep C viruses have come from within Europe. They know that there are different strains of hepatitis C, and even within those different strains, there are different gene maps. And by knowing those things and knowing where things are more common within Europe, they can, or where they found a particular genotype or a particular gene in within Europe, they could try to figure out, if they then found it in another area of Europe, whether it has moved, or in some cases of patients having multiple different genes that were associated with a variety of different countries. And in fact, that's what they found. Unfortunately, many of the patients that were hepatitis C positive not only had one strain, but had multiple strains. They call them clusters in that there are different genes that are all clustered together, and there were some of the patients had as much as 3 or 5 clusters per area on the hepatitis C virus, which tells us that not just the fact that gay men travel, but that individuals, when they're traveling, are having most probably multiple sex partners, or that they're getting infected with individuals that have all those different strains at the same time. So what are the implications? What does that mean for people now, for gay men that are HIV positive, that are having sex? It means that if you're a gay man and you're going to have unprotected sex, you not only have to worry about becoming HIV positive, but beware, you can get hepatitis C as well. And hepatitis C with HIV is a combination that you really don't want to have to deal with. It's definitely a road for quick destruction if you have both of those viruses. And the treatment for hepatitis C, as I said before, is pretty awful.
So this has also implications for people who are positive and having unprotected sex.
Yes, a lot of people are barebacking, thinking that, you know, just because you're positive and you're having sex with another person that you're positive, and say both individuals are undetectable, a lot of gay men think that there's nothing that's really going to happen. They're already positive. When in fact, most individuals that are hepatitis C positive may not even be aware that they're positive, or that kind of communication or discussion about their, you know, what infections they've had is rarely shared, you know, prior to having anonymous sex. But you can easily get hepatitis C by barebacking as well. And along with the parties that go on, the barebacking parties, a lot of individuals use a lot of recreational drugs such as crystal methamphetamine, which has seemed to have steamrolled the epidemic in terms of HIV as well as hepatitis C.
And I know there have been recent news about syphilis, so it's kind of related in a way.
It is. I mean, back in Chicago, we've seen over the last few years a huge increase in syphilis infections. And a lot of the patients that present with syphilis don't always know that they have syphilis. They come in sometimes just having routine STD testing. We find out that they're syphilis positive. They never had any symptoms. And unfortunately, a lot of people that do come in with syphilis, they not only come in with a particular symptom, but they come in extremely sick. And there's been a recent study that actually showed that people that are now presenting with syphilis, that as much as 5% of individuals already have syphilis that has been affecting the central nervous system, which is what we call tertiary syphilis, or the late stage of syphilis.
Huh. So what does this mean in terms of monitoring? Hepatitis C, let's go back to, and syphilis. So does this mean that you should ask your doctor to give you a hepatitis C test every year, and as well as a syphilis test?
I think anybody that's sexually active can get any infection. So anyone that's sexually active should probably be testing 3 or 4 times a year. And when they get their STD testing, they should also ask their doctor not just for their HIV test, but a hepatitis C test as well. Also, for people that are HIV positive, being sexually active, they should also periodically get a test for hepatitis C as well. Also, it's not uncommon for liver enzymes to be increased on account of taking antiviral medications. We shouldn't always accept the fact that if the liver enzymes are slightly elevated, that's due to the medications that we're taking. We should ask our doctor to also check for hepatitis C, because often it's a surprise, but it's hepatitis C that causes the elevated liver enzymes.
Hmm. Very interesting. There was another hepatitis C-related story about treatment interruptions and people who are co-infected with hepatitis B or C. Can you talk a little bit about this study?
Yeah, that study, Bonnie, was called the SMART study. And we have recently, or last year, heard about the SMART study. It made a lot of big news. It was a study that was very well designed. It was a huge study in the fact that more than 5,000 patients took part in it. And the focus of the study was to see whether we can have patients taking the medications and then come off their medications for a period of time, what we call treatment interruptions. And during the course of the study, the big surprise and revelation was the fact that individuals who came off of their HIV medications got sick faster than people that stayed on their medications. And the problems that they developed were problems that we always thought may have been due to HIV medications, when in fact we found out that they were not due to the medications, but due in fact to perhaps HIV being untreated. And those complications were liver problems, kidney problems, as well as heart problems. So what's being presented here in terms of hepatitis is they looked at a small subset of the patients that took part in the study that were also co-infected with hepatitis C or hepatitis B. And they looked at what occurred during the course of the study in terms of people taking those treatment interruptions. And among the people that took treatment interruption in the study, the treatment interruptions occurred if their T-cell counts were above 350 cells, and they were continued to be monitoring off their medications. But if their T-cells went below 250, their doctor needed to restart medications. So there was this time in between the above 350 that they were off treatment till the time that they dropped to below 250 where they needed to go back on treatment. And during that course of time, as I mentioned, they saw all these complications, kidney, liver, as well as cardiac problems. Well, they looked at the subset of what about the patients that were co-infected with hepatitis. Did those individuals do as well as the people that didn't have hepatitis? Did anything change? Did having hepatitis have any effect on the treatment interruption? And in fact, they found that the individuals that were co-infected with hepatitis B actually needed to go on medications much, much faster than the individuals that were not co-infected. So, for example, the average amount of time that people were able to be off their medications in the study was approximately 17 months. The average amount of time that someone that had hepatitis B turned out to be only 7 months. So that's really a strong statement in terms of what happens to a person's immune system if they're actually infected with hepatitis B, that it's actually hepatitis B that caused probably a rapid deterioration in their T-cell count that impacted on their doctors having to restart the medications that much sooner. So that means that if you're a patient and you have a chronic hepatitis B infection on top of your HIV and you're thinking about possibly taking a drug holiday, you need to discuss this with your doctor and take into account the possibility that your T-cell counts may drop very quickly. And I know that in terms of seeing patients at North Star in Chicago, that sometimes when patients go off their medications, they all of a sudden think that everything's okay, that they don't really need to, they don't have to constantly be reminded that they're HIV positive, and they may not even come back to their doctor visits the way they routinely had prior to being on medications. But if you're not taking medications, perhaps you need to be monitored much more cautiously and closely than someone that's actually taking the medications. And if you have hepatitis B, even more closely.
Wow. Let's move on. Another study at IS is the Titan study that showed that the protease inhibitor Prezista is as good, if not better, than Kaletra. What do you think this means for patients?
Well, that study is becoming the most talked about study here in Sydney right at the outset. It's really great to be here in Sydney because it's such a beautiful city, and the people that are coming here from the United States are traveling more than 20 hours, and so that really makes it not an easy conference for most people to attend. It automatically has made it that most of the physicians and investigators that really do a lot of the research have come together here on the other side of the world, and it's really great to see everybody and talk about these new studies. The Titan study, and I love the term Titan. Actually, I think of the Battle of the Titans. you know, those old some of those old movies where they have some of those monsters, you know, fighting each other. But actually, the Titan study, as it's called, is actually a really appropriate word, because Kaletra is has been a Titan for a long time in its own right, in the fact that it is always felt to be one of the biggest, strongest HIV protease inhibitors, and is often used up front by many doctors, and often used even when somebody's failing their first regimen. Physicians often would put them on Kaletra. Prezista, on the other hand, is a very new protease inhibitor, and it has gotten its strength from the fact that over the years, people that are HIV positive had developed more and more resistance to antiviral drugs, and physicians often would not know what to do with those patients, how to best treat those patients. Often, we've stopped trying to get patients to undetectability. We were only trying to maintain their CD4 or T-cell counts. But when Prezista started becoming studied in the clinic, we found that actually, despite the fact that individuals had triple-class resistance or resistance to every medication that was available, they still went undetectable if they were on Prezista. And so Prezista made its own niche in terms of the patient that's been on treatment for a very long period of time. And it has become something, what doctors call, change the paradigm in treatment. It changed the fact that we can have the same goal of getting to undetectability for patients that have resistance as we once thought only that we can get for naive patients, people that are just starting on medications. So these two strong medications were pitted against each other, but not in the patient population for whom had lots of resistance, but simply for people that maybe were on their first regimen, failed their first regimen, and looking for what would be the next thing right after that first regimen. So if you were on, for example, Sustiva, or say you were on a combination being maybe on, say, Truvada and Lexiva, or being on, you know, any other combination, all you need, if you were failing that regimen, you can be a patient that volunteer and be randomized to either being put on Kaletra or being put on Prezista. And of course, the doctor didn't choose the medication, it was randomly assigned to each patient. But the patients knew which drug they were taking, and the physicians knew which drug they were taking. So what did they find? And actually, I should just mention one other thing. Because it was patients that didn't have a lot of resistance, they really didn't need Fusion. They didn't need to be on. They never were on Kaletra before this, and they never were on Aptivus. They never were on Prezista before the study. So what did they find during the study? The patients that actually were on Prezista, more of those patients went to undetectability than the patients that were on Kaletra overall. And it wasn't a very tiny amount, but it actually, the difference was approximately 11%. So to be didactic about numbers, and for all of those of you that are number fans, 60% of the patients that were on Kaletra went to undetectability versus 71% of the patients on Prezista. That's 11. 71 minus 60 is 11. 11% difference.
Is that a statistical difference?
That was felt to be highly statistically significant. They also looked at a number of other things. They looked at for people that developed resistance in the study. Say there were a few patients that failed treatment, and they found that people that were on Prezista actually developed less resistant mutations than the people that were failing Kaletra. People on Kaletra developed more resistance problems. Another thing that was very interesting is that diarrhea, what we call grade 2 to grade 4, the ones that require treatment, were actually twice as more common in patients taking Kaletra versus the Prezista. So what does that mean? So that means that if you're a patient that you're taking your first regimen, say you're on Sustiva, or say you're on another protease inhibitor regimen, and it looks like your viral load is going up and it's looks like that the regimen isn't working the way it used to work, and your doctor needs to look at what next medication to choose from. In the past, we had, you know, maybe your doctor had thought that we'll leave Prezista, you know, down the road when you have resistance to everything. But this study actually showed that if you use Prezista at this point, you, as opposed to Caletra, that you have a better chance of getting to undetectability, and you probably will have, and if you're one of those people that tend to have diarrhea, or if diarrhea is a problem, you may not want to be on Caletra, you may want to favor Prezista. But this whole gestalt of what I just said about choosing Prezista over Caletra is still being talked about during the conference, and physicians are going back and forth about how to read the study, you know, looking at different types of patients that were in the study, and it's still being talked about as to whether Prezista is going to be moving up to the forefront in terms of being used that much earlier.
So stay tuned, in other words, to find out what happens.
Same bat channel. Same bat station.
There was another study that looked at Prezista that also included the still experimental drug etravirine. Can you tell us the importance of this study?
Yes, Bonnie, of course. anything you ask. The Prezista etravirine, or otherwise we would also call it TMC-125, is a new non-nucleoside. It's a new non-nuke. It's in the same family as Sestiva or Virimune. And it's been developed because people that have developed resistance to Virimune or Sestiva often have no more non-nukes in the class to go to. In other words, they develop cross-resistance to one or the other drug, and there's no second-generation non-nuke. So here comes etravirine, or TMC-125, and it was shown early on that for people that have resistance to Sestiva or Virimune, that you can actually go to etravirine without having to absolutely need to go to a protease inhibitor. But that's not what this study is about, actually. What this study is about is for people that have resistance to a lot of the medications that are available, not just to the non-nukes, not just to Sestiva or Virimune, but if for patients that had resistance to, that showed some resistance to protease inhibitors as well, for the people that have that type of problem, in terms of their doctors wanting to choose a combination, there's a lot of choices now because several of the new drugs are on expanded access programs as well, and those are choices for doctors that participate in those programs. So, for example, the Merck Integrase MK0518 is available on expanded access program. Maraviroc, the entry inhibitor, is also available on expanded access, and so is etravirine. And so a doctor can actually choose any of those drugs. They can also use Fusion or T20. And so you've got a bunch of new drugs, some new classes, and how does the doctor figure out like which drug to use when you're having resistance? So this is actually the first study that took two of the newest drugs and put them together and compared it to, say, one of the drugs with combinations that the doctor decided to use as background. And it showed that etravirine, if it was paired with Prezista, that it showed very interesting promise in that most of those patients, more patients, when they paired Prezista with etravirine, did better than doing Prezista by itself with their usual background medications in the cocktail. And so it just provides more hope for people that have resistance. It provides more confidence for doctors in terms of knowing which drug they may want to pair with Prezista, that maybe it's not necessary to go to Fusion, where patients need to give themselves injections twice a day. They can actually choose a pill to take twice a day, which obviously is more easy.
How were the side effects on this study? Do you remember?
Yes. Etravirine is really is extremely well tolerated. They also looked at, because the non-nucleoside class has had a reputation, such as, for example, sativa causes a lot of what's called central nervous system side effects, brain effects. In other words, you know, people know that you take sativa at nighttime before you go to bed, because if you don't, you know, you feel like you're a zombie, and because it causes a lot of sedation. Also, it causes increased dreams, and some people have noticed that they've been a little bit more anxious when they've taken sativa. And so they looked at these central nervous system side effects, found that etravirine wasn't a problem. They also looked at skin rash problems. They did, you know, because Viramune causes skin rashes as well as sativa, they actually found that etravirine can cause a skin rash, but most of them were mild. They were able to actually treat through that. So etravirine, it looks like a more easily tolerated medication in those respects, and it looks very promising.
Great. And finally, there was a study that was very interesting. It showed that patients will no longer have to deal with hypersensitivity reactions if they take Zyogen because of a new test that predicts who will get the reaction and who won't. Can you tell me a little bit about that test?
Yes, the test is actually a milestone, not just in HIV treatment, but in modern medicine. It's one of the first examples of how we're using the field of mapping out people's genes and how we can construct treatment based on their genetic makeup. And actually, this test, which is called the HLA-B5701, test, is actually a variant in a person's gene. And for the people that have that variant, they have a much higher rate of developing this severe allergic reaction to Zyogen than people that don't have it. In other words, if you don't have the gene, it's extremely unlikely that you will ever get that reaction. If you do have the gene, there's a very high likelihood that you will get it. So what does this mean? If your doctor is considering whether to put you on Zyogen or Epsicom, instead of having to worry about, will I get this reaction, and if I get this reaction, I need to call my doctor, and if I call my doctor and it's the reaction, I can never take Zyogen ever again, your doctor can actually do this simple blood test, see if you have this genetic variant. And if you do, we know not to put you on either Zyogen or Epsicom, and we go to a different medication. On the other hand, if you don't have this gene, and you know 95% of the population doesn't, then your doctor can safely put you on Zyogen, and it's extremely unlikely that you would get that severe allergic reaction for which Zyogen has this current black box warning on it right now because of that. Also, if you are on Zyogen and you've been doing well, you don't need to get this test because obviously you've not had the reaction and you're home free. There's no reason to draw this test at that point. Also, one other caveat, if you do the test looking for this HLA-B5701, all you need to do is know the results of the test. Your doctor documented very well in the chart, and it's only needed to be done once in a lifetime. It doesn't need to be checked every year or every so many years. It's just a one test, once in a lifetime, and you know whether Zyogen can potentially cause a problem or not right before you even take it.
How soon will these tests be rolled out? I mean, can I get it tomorrow at my doctor's office?
You can. In fact, I've been ordering it. Because we participated in one of the studies, it was part of the study, but some doctors have already begun using it. It's been used in Europe more widely as well. And it's a test that is not unlike gene typing that's sometimes done prior to gene typing before transplants, and sometimes we also use gene typing for people with different diseases like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. It's, you know, those markers are used as an indicator for those diseases. So this specific test for Zyogen hypersensitivity, or the back of your hypersensitivity reaction is available.
Great. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Dr. Berger. Thanks so much for your terrific review of IAS 2007 highlights.
Thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on IAS 2007 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/IAS2007.